Good morning. This is Hugh LaFont, your host for Ideas and Issues. On our program this week, I'm talking with Thomas Pokey in the Philosophy Department at Columbia University, and our topic is global economic justice. Thomas, glad to have you on the show.
Yeah, hi, how are you?
I know most people out there, most of the listeners, are familiar that with the fact that there are people who are poor in the world, the fact that there are people who are starving the world, but I'm not sure they have any clue about the extent of that poverty, just how serious it is and how extensive it is. I wonder if you could begin by giving the listener a brief overview of the what you mean by poverty and how many impoverished people there are in the world.
Yeah, we have relatively good data about this question from the World Bank, which monitors these things on an annual basis, and they basically have two different poverty lines, which are colloquially referred to as the $1 a day poverty line and the $2 a day poverty line. And basically what they mean by that is the purchasing power that $1.08 or $2.15 respectively had in the year 1993. So in today's money, basically people count as very poor if they have less than $482 per year in purchasing power per person, and as poor if they have less than twice that amount, $965. Now, in exchange rates today, that comes given the higher purchasing power that money has in the developing countries. In exchange rates, these two poverty lines today come to roughly $120 per person per year for the lower poverty line and $241 per person per year for the higher poverty line. Now, the number of people who are below these two lines respectively are 1.2 billion or 1,200 million people below the lower poverty line and 2,800 million people below the higher poverty line. That amounts with respect to the lower poverty line to about one-fifth of the world's population and 46% of the world's population below the higher of the two poverty lines. So it's a very significant number of people who live on less than $241 per year.
All right, so if we take the generous number, at least one out of every five people in the world is impoverished, and the figure we're talking about when we're talking about impoverished here is much, much more than what we think about as being impoverished in the United States.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, if you think about how we would get by with $965 per person per year, it's almost impossible to imagine getting by on that amount of money. And that is the poverty line, the higher, the more generous of the two poverty lines. And basically, the fact that you can buy more for money in the developing world is already factored into this line, because we're talking here about purchasing power parities rather than about real exchange rate dollars.
Now, when you say these people, too, are below the poverty line, I mean, we're trying to get the sense now just of what we could call the absolute level of poverty. How much below the poverty line are they on average?
Again, we have detailed data on that. If you take the lower poverty line, people are on average 30% below that line. If you take the upper poverty line, people are on average 44.4% below that poverty line. So you can say, again, taking the higher of the two poverty lines, the average person who is poor, and remember this is almost half of all human beings, does not have the purchasing power of $965, but the average person has only $537 in purchasing power per year.
Could you talk a little bit about what the consequences of this are? I mean, obviously it means that people have to scramble in order to simply get enough food to stay alive, but what else does it mean?
What else does it mean? First of all, it means premature deaths. You have roughly 18 million premature deaths per year that are caused by poverty. And these are, I mean, the specific causes are starvation and malnutrition first and foremost, but also various kinds of very trivial diseases that could be cured simply and cheaply, such as measles, tuberculosis, diarrhea, and so on, diseases that for us are trivial and not even worth thinking about. But people there don't have basic vaccines, basic medications, rehydration packages, and so on, which for a few cents could actually cure this. Now, if you think 18 million deaths a year from poverty-related causes, that is fully one-third of all human deaths. Besides that, of course, you have people who are malnourished as children, having stunted growth both physically and mentally, will never be fully functioning human beings the way the rest of us here are in the developed countries. You have people, you know, very high incidence of people who are not educated enough, who don't have the ability to read and write, and so will for their entire lives not be able to apply for jobs, will not be able to make good incomes, and so forth. So on the whole, the consequences are quite horrendous and affect people's whole life, if they even survive into adulthood, which many do not. You know, of the people, the 18 million people who die prematurely, the larger part of those people are actually children who die already during childhood.
So the figure of 18 million, I mean, to get put that in some kind of perspective, depending upon how you carve up the population of New York City, that it's more than, I think, than the population of the city proper and some substantial number of what's considered the metropolitan area of New York, that number of people would die every year from starvation or poverty-related causes. Is that correct?
Yeah, that is correct. And basically, if you think about the period since the end of the Cold War, which I think is a very significant period in the sense that while we were still in the Cold War, we were spending a lot of money, obviously, in trying to defend ourselves against the Soviet threat and so on. And afterwards, we really, I think, should have done more to try to combat hunger and try to reduce this problem. In this period since the end of the Cold War, something like 250 million people have died from poverty-related causes. And if you think of the names of these people memorized in the way of the Vietnam Wall, the memorial in Washington, D.C., you would get a wall that is 400 miles long. That gives you some sort of sense of the magnitude of the problem.
Now, the other point that you make in your writings on this issue is that the issue is not simply that there is this absolute level of poverty, but that what makes it more bothersome morally is that the poverty is so enormous relative to the wealth of many of us.
Yeah, that is right. And, of course, the enormous discrepancy in income and wealth gives you a sense of how easily poverty could be avoided. Right? Many people who think about the problem and who know the basic facts about poverty, they say, look, there are 1,200 million people out there who are very poor. There are 2,800 million people out there who are poor. And how can we possibly help all these people? There are just too many people. It's just a problem that we can't do anything about. But if you look at how much income these people actually have, that the very poor have only one-third of 1% of the entire global product, and the poor, almost half of humankind, have only 1.2% of the entire global product, then you see how very easy it would be to change the global institutions, the global economy, in such a way that these people have, let's say, twice the income they have now, which would be sufficient to solve the entire poverty problem. Now, if we doubled their income in some way from 1.2% to 2.4%, they say, this would just be a loss for us of less than 1.5% of our income. So the inequality is so enormous that poverty, despite the fact that it affects so many people, is quite easily avoidable.
And I know there's one particular figure you gave in one of your writings that I thought was absolutely astounding, that the three richest people in the world have more wealth than the combined gross national product of all the least developed countries in the world, and that's 600 million people.
Yeah.
But I take it your point is not just that the inequality is between these extremely rich people, but the inequality is also dramatic between people like you and I.
Yeah,
and
that is,
these poor people.
That is right, sure. And basically, if you want to get it in terms of a ratio, the income of people in the developed countries, I mean, of us, just ordinary average people, our income is about 318 times the income of the very poor and about 206 times the income of the poor.
Okay, which is pretty dramatic. Now, the next obvious question is, what's the explanation for this? Why is there such enormous poverty in the world? You know, some people might say, well, it's laziness, or maybe the problem is they simply don't have enough willpower or effort or economic savvy in order to make their economies work. Is that something like that the best explanation, or are there better ones?
Well, I think there are certainly better explanations than that. I think the first thing we have to realize is that poverty has social causes. That is to say that people are not in any way, they're not genetically different from us. I don't think they are lazier than we are. It's quite obvious that the vast majority of people who are poor and live in the developing world would be quite as capable of leading happy and successful lives if they were born in better places, if they were born in the United States, for example, or in Britain or in Italy, or a place like that. So poverty has social causes, but the big question then is, are these, what sort of social causes are there? And in this regard, economists and social theorists more generally tend to stress the social causes that are domestic to the country in which poverty occurs. So they stress such things as defective institutions in those countries, defective policies in these countries, corruption in these countries, and maybe the culture of those countries. So you have lots of explanations of that sort. Now, in general, I think that these explanations certainly contribute, and they're certainly important in many ways, that there are differences of that sort, and these differences are important. But I also think that we have to ask more deeply about what the explanation is for the differences that we find. Why is it that corruption is so common in these countries? Why is it that bad government is so common in these countries? And as soon as we ask these further questions, I think we will quite quickly come to global factors that have an important influence on the defects that are prevalent in these countries. So start with bribery, for example, with corruption. Why is there so much bribery? Why is that part of the way of life in many of the developing countries? Well, I don't think that's unrelated to the fact that until very recently, most developed countries not only permitted their firms to bribe officials in the developing world, but also allowed them to tax deduct any bribes that they were paying to them. So in this way, they were giving moral approval and also financial incentives to bribing officials in developing countries. And that, of course, creates a culture of corruption, because obviously firms coming from the rich countries can pay much more and can offer bribes that are very significant relative to the salaries that officials get paid in the developing world. And so a culture of corruption was bred to some extent, or actually to a large extent, through these foreign influences. Another factor that one might mention is that the fact that many authoritarian and very repressive governments manage to keep themselves in power in the developing world is not unrelated to the fact that we supply arms to these governments, and also that we are willing to lend money to these governments in the name of the whole country and are willing to buy the resources from the people who run these countries. So we essentially, on the basis of the exercise of power alone, recognize the rulers of these countries as the legitimate government. We give them money in loans, we give them money for the resources they export to us, and we sell them the weapons with which they can then cement their rule and keep themselves in power, borrowing more money and selling more resources.
Okay, I want to pursue a number of these topics in the second half of the show. I'd like to pause just for a second. For those who may have tuned in late, this is Ideas and Issues. My guest today is Thomas Pogge, professor of philosophy at Columbia University, and we're talking about global economic justice. Let me actually go back and just reiterate one point that you made earlier. And the issue here is not so much perhaps the global economy as looking at particular individuals. That if you think of you or I, and you were to put us in one of these developing countries, the likelihood is that you or I would be in the very same boat. We would be impoverished. We would be scrambling for food. We would be trying to make ends meet. And we might be one of those 18 million people that died. On the other hand, if you could somehow have picked up some of those children at infancy and brought them to the United States or to Great Britain or to other places in Europe, then they probably would have been living just lives that would be absolutely fine. So to some degree, the reason we are better off than they are individually is a matter of luck.
Yeah.
But you want to go further than that, I take it. And you want to say that it's not just luck, that we've established economic and political institutions which effectively encourage the impoverishment of individuals. I mean, it's not that we say, all right, what are we going to do to make these people impoverished? It's that we engage in policies that we see as promoting our own interests, our own national interests, our own Western interests, perhaps. And if one of the consequences of those policies is that people are impoverished, then so be it. Is that fair to say?
I should maybe clarify one point about what you're saying. I'm not saying that this is a matter of evil or bad will on the part of the developed countries so much as it is simply a product of ordinary negotiations that go on where the parties that are negotiating differ from each other very much in terms of their expertise and bargaining power. So think, for example, of the much-discussed WTO, the World Trade Organization, and the Uruguay Round, in the course of which many of the rules that are now governing the world economy were negotiated. You have people there, negotiators, sitting around a table from different countries, and you know the rich countries come there with enormous delegations, with enormous expertise. The poor countries come there, and they basically don't have the capacity to even think through the various rule proposals and how they themselves, their own country, will be affected by them. And moreover, of course, the rich countries have much greater bargaining power in these negotiations. And so it's not very surprising that the negotiations, very often the outcome of these negotiations, will reflect the interests of the rich and developed countries more than the interests of the developing countries. So when it comes to fixing, let's say, tariffs or copyrights or any kind of rules that are now governing the world economy, you'll find that these rules tend to favor the rich countries at the expense of the poor countries. And so the differentials in income and wealth not only get cemented, but they get aggravated by the fact that the rules favor those countries that are already richer over those countries that are already poorer. Now, that's exactly what we find. We find, since the end of the Cold War, a very dramatic increase in global inequality, with the poorer people actually becoming poorer and the richer becoming richer, so that the poor countries and the poor populations in particular cannot get anything like a proportional share of global economic growth. In fact, the movement is, to some extent, even backwards.
Okay. So the issue, I mean, again, if I implied earlier that your view was that this was malice on the part of the Western countries, I apologize. I don't think that's your view at all.
I don't think you suggested that. I was just trying to clarify that I didn't hold that position because you kind of left it open.
Sure. And I'm sure there are people who do think that's what's going on.
Right.
What I was thinking of when I was asking the question is, when I've talked to other guests who hold somewhat different positions from you, they'll say things like, well, the job of the United States is to negotiate what is in our best interest. And once you begin to fill out, at least on a certain view, what that means, it means we get the best bargain we can for ourselves, even if it means the other person is substantially disadvantaged by that bargain. And it sounds as if that's basically what you're saying is going on here. It's that because we have these vast differences in power, in income, in wealth, in resources, that just in the normal range of bargaining, we're able to get more by giving less than the people on the poor end of the stick.
Yeah. Yeah, let me say maybe one other thing about that, namely, on the whole, I'm all in favor of this picture of competition, of free markets, of an adversarial system. But in all the domestic cases that we know of this sort of thing, for example, in a courtroom where you have defense attorneys and the prosecution fighting it out, or in the market where you have competing corporations fighting it out, or in politics where you have parties competing for political power, in all of those contexts that we are familiar with, there are independent mechanisms and constraints at work that preserve a level playing field. And it is these independent mechanisms and constraints that are completely lacking in the international arena. In the international arena, basically, we have a lopsided discrepancy, great centrifugal tendencies that lead to greater and greater inequalities, which in turn make the rules more and more unbalanced in favor of the strong and against the weak. And so you have a process that goes on and on. Whereas in, for example, the domestic economy, if one company becomes too strong, we have antitrust legislation that makes sure that other companies can still compete with it. Again, there are constraints that prevent one party, for example, from rigging the rules of the political competition in such a way that they can preserve themselves in power indefinitely. And it is these constraints that I think we should also try to implement on the global level to make sure that we really have a fair competition.
So that in some sense what you're advocating is that we should do globally what we take for granted within our own country. That we have rules against monopolies. We have rules against monopolies because we know that if you are a monopoly, you can take advantage of people who are buying your products. You can ask increased prices and give fewer services. We think that's inappropriate. We think that there ought to be some kind of constraints upon it. And you, it sounds to me like you're saying we just ought to do the same thing in the global market.
Yes, we have to have some constraints on the extent of inequality. We have to make sure that the interests of the poor populations are adequately represented in negotiations about the rules. And currently these people are represented essentially by their rulers, who, as I've said, are on the one hand for the most part repressive and corrupt and don't really care very much about the poverty in their own countries. And on the other hand also don't have either the bargaining power or the expertise to effectively make a difference to the outcome of these negotiations. So that is essentially what has to change. We have to make sure that there is at least a rough parity in the representation that the interests of the poor and the interests of the rest of us have in the designing of the rules under which we then all compete economically, politically, and so forth.
Well, in brief, what would you propose as mechanisms that we could use to both bring about the parity that you're talking about in negotiation and also make it less likely that we end up supporting directly or indirectly regimes that don't really care for their own citizens?
Yeah, let me start with the latter, perhaps. I think we should be much more careful in the support that we give to rulers of developing countries on the basis of merely their exercising effective power. So we should not recognize the likes of the junta in Burma, for example, or Sani Abacha or dictators the world over, merely because they hold power in a given country as entitled to borrow in the country's name and as entitled to sell the natural resources of those countries. And this is not maybe something that should be done by each Western government individually, but rather we should have some sort of a United Nations organization that can in real time make an authoritative determination as to whether a particular government exercises power in accordance with the Constitution and with at least minimal representativeness for the people that live in the country that it rules. So that's one thing where one could try to at least reduce somewhat the incentives for the unconstitutional and forceful takeover of power in the developing countries. As you know, now, for the most part, these countries are not governed democratically, and that is one big problem, which, of course, leads to these countries not being, or the populations of these countries not being well represented. Another thing we should do is we should try to make sure that the great gap that now exists between rich and poor is at least somewhat mitigated so that the poor are better able to fend for themselves. One obvious solution there would be to open our markets to the products that are imported from the very poorest countries. The United Nations Conference on Trade and Development, called UNCTAD, has recently estimated that the poor countries are losing roughly $700 billion of export opportunities each year because we are trying to protect various industries of ours from cheap imports, such as agriculture and textiles in particular. Now, $700 billion annually is a vast amount of money for the developing world, much, much larger than all the development aid that the developed countries are giving to the developing countries. And if we just opened our markets, if we just said, okay, let these people at least export goods to us without constraints, we would already make an enormous difference to the poverty problem and help the poor countries and populations to catch up with us.
Okay, in the last 3 minutes, I wanted to ask you a question. You used the term aid a moment ago, and certainly that's the way most Americans, and I'm assuming many people in the Western country think of it, is that we're giving aid to assistance to economic humanitarian aid to people who are impoverished. And I take it part of what you want to say is that that's a mistake, at least in part a mistaken way of describing what's going on. That because we've taken advantage of these impoverished people, we have a stronger moral obligation to somehow give them recompense for what we've done to them. Or am I reading more into your work than perhaps you want to put there?
No, I think what you're saying is quite right. I mean, think about, let's say, an earlier stage of European history where you had a feudalist economy, extreme inequalities in wealth and income, people living in great poverty and in great personal dependence on their lords and so on. And we say today this was a very unjust economic system. And in that system, somebody might have appealed to the rich and might have said, look, you should give some of your great wealth away to poor people and make sure that they can feed their children and so forth. Now, I don't object to calling that aid, but I think, as you rightly pointed out, the moral grounds for doing that are stronger than they would be if we were just somebody out of left field, basically somebody coming onto the situation being an innocent bystander and saying, here, people who are very poor, I've got a lot of money, so why don't I help these people? We do have, as participants in a system that unjustly advantages us and unjustly disadvantages them, we do have a certain responsibility to mitigate the harms that by participating and helping to uphold the system, we also help to produce.
Okay, in the last minute, if a listener wanted to find out more about this issue and wanted to take some positive steps to try to cope with the problem of world poverty, what might they do?
Well, I think there are basically two different strategies of what one might do. One strategy would be to try to promote reforms in the way of, for example, reminding our politicians, our representatives, that we have a responsibility to design fair rules of international trade and so on. And bringing this issue to the forefront in public debates, trying to promote reforms. The other thing is to do these kinds of compensatory methods that I talked about earlier, you actually started talking about, namely in terms of aid. There are many organizations out there, from Médecins Sans Frontières to Oxfam and so forth, organizations, UNICEF one might mention, that will mitigate hunger and will try to help people, poor people in the developing countries, build a life and try to minimize the lasting effects of poverty that so many people are now suffering from, childhood malnutrition and so forth.
Okay, well, thank you very much for appearing on the show today. It's been a great pleasure talking to you.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thank you.
I've been speaking today with Thomas Pogge in the Philosophy Department at Columbia University. This is Hugh LaFollette for Ideas and Issues. Good day.